Oh my God, you're like listening to Good Day World with Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. Whatever.
G'day world, you're listening to the Podcast Network. My name's Cameron Riley. I'm sitting in the very lovely home in Brisbane of a man who is a tastemaker. He's a music writer, a music critic. He's been called the man who invented grunge. He's the man who introduced Kurt Cobain to Courtney Love and lived to write the book about it. The man, the legend who calls himself Everett True. Officially, welcome to Brisbane.
Thank you.
Mr. True.
Thank you.
You've been here...
I've been here longer than you, right?
No, not quite. Okay. I've been here a couple of months.
You've been here since June?
I've been here since April.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I beat you.
Okay.
I got a good friend of mine who lives in Seattle who asked me to ask you how you would compare Brisbane to Seattle.
Less heroin because it's nicer weather.
Now you got to talk at the microphone, mate. Oh. If you talk over that way, it won't work.
Really?
Yeah. No, I know you're new to this interviewing game, but you got to talk into the microphone.
Less heroin because it's nicer weather. It's pretty much as beautiful, though. I do think Seattle, for all its corporate dollars, is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been to.
Mm-hmm.
And Brisbane, I think, certainly is pretty close. You know, it doesn't have quite the devastatingly awesome countryside surrounding it that Seattle does. But beyond, but apart from that, yeah, kind of similar. Similar in as much as both are small towns that think themselves big cities and have the accompanying mindset. Seattle's lost that a little bit in the last 10, 15 years because obviously it became a big city. It still needs to do a bit of catching up. And Brisbane, obviously someone around here is extremely rich. You can tell that just from the amount of building work going on all the time and the amount of fancy buildings. And I think it's because of natural resources, is that right?
Queensland, I believe,
has
so.
A lot of natural resources.
Yeah, we're just, you know, raping the earth and selling it to the Chinese, man.
And So similar, very similar in as much as they're small towns that think themselves big cities and isolated, of course.
But so far,
there are quite
lifestyle,
a few parallels.
Lifestyle, you like it?
You'd recommend it? Yeah, Brisbane's ace. You know, I mean, that's why we're here, you know. It's laid back, it's beautiful.
And he's not saying that because I just bought him noodles for lunch either.
It's way too expensive. I can't believe how expensive it is here.
Yeah, you and me both.
That's such a shame because I know if we come out a couple of years ago, it would have been really cheap still.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just the way it goes.
If you'd come out 200 years ago with your forefathers, you could have just taken the whole thing for free.
Could have done.
They had the right idea. Just go and take the real estate when it's available. Now, mate, we're primarily here because I'm interested to talk to you about why you've pissed off everybody in the music industry, apparently, in this country with some of your recent comments about the state of Australian music and the Australian music press. To recap for people who didn't catch all of this, which would be pretty hard because it's had a fair amount of coverage in the mainstream media.
It was on the front of MX magazine.
Oh, well, you know you've made it.
Yeah.
I had a girl from MX magazine ring me... couple of weeks ago, she wanted to interview me about podcasting stats, and she said, do you have any stats? And I said, well, no, we don't have any real stats, but what do you care? You're only MX, just make them up, like you make everything else up. And she got really offended. But I didn't understand it. I thought they were proud of the fact they're a Murdoch paper. They just make shit up. Anyway, so yeah, you said you called Australian bands like Silverchair, The Vines and Savage Garden musical abominations. Do you hold to that?
I called them abominations against nature.
Abominations against nature? Okay, well, that's even better. I like that.
Well, you know, as I've said several times since, first up, I wasn't commenting on the state of Australian music. I was just using that as a throwaway line in an article about the state of critical discourse in Australia. It was just a throwaway line to indicate, to illustrate one of the arguments I was making, one of the points I was making. So it certainly wasn't a comment on Australian music. And I guess the second point is, you know, I'm a music critic. I'm not really a critic as such. I just give things a tick or a cross and say, oh, yeah, I like it. That's about all I do. I don't like taking things apart and examining them because that kind of destroys the thrill of music for me.
No flowery prose required.
Oh, I hate it. No, just put a tick or a cross in the required box.
Listen to it or don't listen to it.
Give it a mark out of 10 and, you know... mark it like it was a maths test or something. That's all you need to do.
Right? No justification required.
No, absolutely not.
I'm with you.
So anyway, I write about music, for better or for worse, and that's the entertainment industry, right? So I always understood from the name. The name's a kind of a giveaway. Entertainment industry. It's meant to be entertaining. So all I do when I write is try to be entertaining. So, you know, I could have just said, oh, I don't like the Vines, and left it at that. But it's like, well, then nobody would pay any attention to my words if I just did that, because that's pretty much what everybody else does anyway. So I'm like, I want to make people remember my words, so I just choose a kind of evocative phrase. Uh-huh. Abominations against nature. Well, yeah, I mean, I think you could probably examine that phrase and it's pretty much true, isn't it?
Well, I have to tell you, I saw the Vines' first official gig in Melbourne in 2001, 2002, I think it was. And it was pretty wild, man. I mean, I thought the lead singer, Craig, was going to get a cymbal smacked through his head by the drummer at the time, who obviously hated his guts. It was pretty rock and roll. They wanted to kill each other. I can't comment on the music.
Well, I saw their first show in the UK, coincidentally. And there was a bit of a hype about them at the time. I don't know where the hype came from. Hype always comes from somewhere, but I don't know where that one particularly came from. They played my local pub in Brighton, which was known as a kind of... It's where kind of music industry people like to send down bands to play because they knew Everett True was there. And they went on stage and there's about 60, 70 people in the audience, and about 5 minutes before they went on, they sent their roadies out to tune up their instruments, and I'm like, where's this band from? Because they sure as hell aren't from Melbourne, because if they're from Melbourne, they wouldn't have lasted 2 seconds in Melbourne. Melbourne knows how to rock, you know, it loves its rock. Band comes out on stage and gets their bloody roadies to tune up for 5 minutes, but, you know, they would have been laughed off stage in Melbourne. It's just like, this band, there's no way this band are from Melbourne for one, Australia for two. They're quite clearly some band from Brooklyn or somewhere pretending to be Australian for that kind of added credibility of rock.
You get added credibility in Australia.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, the one thing Australian bands have always known how to do is to rock.
Give me some examples.
AC/DC and Birthday Party. I mean, they're the two really obvious ones.
Obvious.
And the Saints. And AJ Birdman. Yeah. You know, I'm citing old examples, but I'm just doing that to show the tradition of it.
To show your age.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I cannot lie. I am, in fact, 83. And so I was just like, man, you know, this band, they're just not very good. And the funny thing was, I wasn't going to write about it. I was doing a magazine called Careless Talk Costs Lives at the time. And I did write about it. And we got a load of advertising pulled. Because what I didn't realise, I was just like, who the hell is signing these bands? You know, do these A&R men, you know, what kind of... And I didn't realise it was actually a friend of mine who'd signed them. And he was kind of pissed off with me because he took it personally. And I was like, well, you just got bad taste. Get over it.
But your point that their hype came from somewhere, they seem to be incredibly manufactured in an unmanufactured kind of way. I mean, they weren't the Spice Girls manufactured, but they all of a sudden appeared on the scene.
They're way more manufactured
massive
than the Spice. No, you see, give me the Spice Girls or All Saints or Pussycat, whatever they are, Dolls, any day over a million chart indie bands who are just... Because at least they're honest.
It doesn't
about
claim
their
to be what it's not.
Yeah.
You know,
give me X Factor any day over the Vines or a thousand kind of boy indie bands. Because it's just very straightforward. This is what it is.
We're vacuous.
It's all about,
pop.
It's all about the melodies. It's pop. You know, sometimes a song will hit home. You know, the lyrics, whoever's writing the lyrics, sometimes you'll connect with them, sometimes you won't. But it's entertainment. I really object to this recent, like in the last 10 years. You know, I don't know where it started, Blur or something, probably. I like Blur. But, you know, Blur and Oasis downwards, like, all of a sudden, indie bands sold millions of records, so they became... people started manufacturing them, and it's like... You know, that to me is a far more heinous crime, because it's like... it's just completely hypocritical. Vines just seem completely manufactured from the word go. I mean, maybe they should have promoted that original drummer to the role of singer and got rid of the singer. Because from the sound of it, this drama is more interesting.
Oh, well, the whole thing is Craig's a complete, you know, heroin freak, and he's, you know, on death's door all the time. That's their whole selling point. But let's be honest, though. I mean, you're a pretty hard man to please. I read a quote where you said that Nirvana was the most overrated, one of the most overrated bands of the 90s.
Yeah, of course they are, because they sold... I mean, that's obvious. I mean, I'm sure Kurt would have agreed with that statement as well. I mean, you know, they weren't the best band by any means that I've ever seen, but they sold more records than all the other bands I've liked put together.
Let the record show the tapping here as it's raining on...
is it raining?
I think so, yeah. Everett's corrugated iron roof.
Yeah, it might be the wind.
No, that's rain, yeah. No? Okay. A lot of crackling anyway. Doesn't matter. Keep going. Overrated, Nirvana.
But I was just making a point. I mean, you know, I like Nirvana just fine. But, you know, whenever anybody's saying, oh, yeah, this man's a god, this, you know, I mean, that's always not true.
Really?
Simple as that. Weirdly. You know, I mean, I suppose except unless you want to start getting into theology again. But I'm not really down with the theologist either, so...
Okay. So tell me about what you do like him. When you go and check
out
bands...
Well, I like Nirvana just fine.
You like Nirvana?
Nirvana are a great
like them, but
band.
Think they were overrated.
Yeah. Because many people paid attention to them. You know, it's like... you got all these magazines out at the moment, you know, from Britain, like Mojo and Uncut, which are all about putting the Beatles on the cover every month. Or if they don't put the Beatles on the cover, they put Pink Floyd on the cover, or they put The Who on the cover, or something. It's like, how many times can you go over the same territory? Is that all life is, that you just look at the same, like, 1 second of existence and just write about it constantly? Is that it? You know, how boring is that? How dull is that? What's the point? You know, all right, maybe this stuff was interesting, but isn't there tons of other interesting stuff?
That's the magazine industry. They put Princess Diana or now Princess Mary of Denmark on the cover every second issue.
Yes, of course, I know.
Let's sell what
people buy. But what's the point? Why do people buy it? You know, why do they keep reading about the same thing over and over and over again?
Because they're branded?
Possibly. I don't think so. I think it's because that's what they've been trained to read.
That's what I mean. That's what they've been conditioned to read, man. They're brain dead. They're just, you know...
No, I'm a great believer
media
in
zombies.
The potential of the popular masses. You know, I grew up at a time in music when punk music was pop music, and songs like The Specials' Ghost Town and The Jam's Going Underground and tens, hundreds of others were going to number one in Britain, and these are great songs, you know, and these were songs I would definitely defend on loads of different fronts. They were going to number one. They were selling a million copies each. Now, the equivalent now would be the Pussycat Dolls or something selling a million records. That's like, so why are people buying this and not the other? You know, because people don't differentiate, because they just buy what's played on the radio. But that's not to say they won't buy intelligent stuff. That's not to say they won't buy really interesting stuff. It just means they're not exposed to it.
And with the... the music industry seems to be in various stages of meltdown at
which
the moment.
Which is great, of course.
It seems to be great.
Oh, well, of course it's great.
Yeah, and, you know, there's this big rise of lots of independent music coverage on blogs and sites like yours and Plan B magazine.
Which is crap,
A million MySpace pages talking about bands. Do you see there's a new future for bands to get discovered in this, or is it going to be harder?
No, it's harder. Unfortunately, what happens? I was looking at a free, like, you know, promotional booklet from the Powerhouse yesterday, from Brisbane Powerhouse, and it's like comedians and music and whatever, just giving you the rundown of their forthcoming events. And every single article carried a quote from the press. You know, they're from, like, I don't know, Metro London, or, you know, the equivalent of MX. Or somebody's blog somewhere, you know, in Buttfuck, Idaho.
That's a real place, by the way.
It is a real place.
Yeah, near Boise.
I've been there several times.
Yeah.
And I saw a Lollapalooza there, actually. And it just devalues the entire thing, the entire process. You know, what's the point of putting these quotes on? You know, it actually makes it more difficult, because there's no kind of... there's no filter. There's no standard being adhered to. I mean, of course, who says what? Who's the person who decides on the standard? I mean, that's an answer I can't. That's a question I can't answer. But it makes it way more difficult, because the problem is, I don't know why, but possibly because there's all these media courses at universities and colleges now, because, you know, they've got to spend the government's money somehow and the taxpayers' money somehow. People grow up believing that they can be journalists, that, you know, the media is a really attractive industry to go into, which it is, of course, because it's way better than having a real job if you can get paid for it.
Sell that to the journalists at Fairfax who are kicking out the door.
Well, of course, but I mean, if you can get paid for it, you know, I'm not talking about necessarily news reporters. but entertainment reporters. And so everybody's like, oh, I want to be a music journalist, you know, I want to be an arts journalist. And it's like, so they think that writing on the internet, writing a blog, or writing, doing some kind of site or whatever, that means they're a music critic. Instantly, bam, you know, they're a music critic. They get sent a couple of free CDs and they're like, wow, you know, I'm a music critic. Now, of course, that doesn't make them a music critic. That just means they're just doing the 2008 equivalent of writing their diary, you know, just reporting back to themselves on some show they saw. But the problem is, everybody's like, oh yeah. I mean, this is one of the great strengths and weaknesses of the internet. I mean, it's marvellous, obviously, you know, that all its information is available. Fantastic, and I love that. I love the way it levels the playing field. But at the same time, you actually need kind of filters in place. You need your choices to be limited, because if you have unlimited choice, you don't have the time to filter through them all.
But doesn't it provide us with the opportunity for unlimited filters then? I mean, people can choose.
Yes, it does, yeah.
People can choose the filters that they want now. Mm. Some people will sign up to Everett True, and some people will sign up to Everett False.
Yeah, which is
Everett
great.
False,
but the problem still remains that there's way too many filters to look at.
Yeah. So we need a filter for the filters, then.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think that's what Google is, in a way. It's the filter of the filters. What about iTunes? Is that a filter?
What they call Microsoft. Oh, is it Apple? I can't tell the difference. yeah, filter into their pockets.
I tell you, you mentioned on one of your blogs recently that you had something like 79,000 tracks in your iPod.
A lot of those are repeats.
Yeah, sure. But do you find that this is changing your relationship to the music that you like to listen to? I can remember, the days 10, 15, 20 years ago when I would buy a CD or an album, you know, once a month, probably once every couple of months, and then listen to it repeatedly until I bought another one.
Yep.
Whereas these days, it's just like...
Well, that's partly down to age. That's definitely down to age. Definitely when you're younger, you have a much fiercer relationship with the music that you listen to. For loads of reasons, mainly because... when you're younger, you have less outside factors which come in and intrude. You know, if you have kids, if you get married, you know, if you get a mortgage, if you get a job, you know, all of these are factors that are going to compete with your time for listening to the music.
Yeah.
So to a degree, that's just circumstance. But not just. I mean, I remember the first time I encountered iTunes, which was a few years back. I was in Olympia, Washington, and I was in the offices of Kill Rock Stars. And one of the people there had iTunes on their computer, and I was like, oh, what's this? You know, and she was just playing music off it. Ramones were followed by Shangri-Las, were followed by... I was like, oh, my God, that is fantastic. You can just randomise your record collection, which, of course, is fantastic because, you know, you're kind of guaranteed to be listening to something you like, but you don't know what it's going to be until it appears, which kind of alleviates the need for radio. Because, I mean, doubly so, because, of course, on radio, you never know whether you're actually going to be listening to something you like.
Although radio would argue that they're a filter.
Yes, of course they would, and I think there's plenty of place for radio. But, yeah, I mean, I think iTunes is fantastic, but the problem actually comes when you're like me and you've got 80,000 tunes on your iTunes, on your iPod, and you don't want to listen to about 50,000 of those at any given point in time, so you actually have to be fast-forwarding through all of them.
Yeah, click.
And also, you kind of do need that physical... I mean, I have, you know, basically I transferred my entire CD collection onto and got rid of my CDs because I never really saw eye to eye with CDs as a format anyway. And the problem with that is it's kind of similar to the fact my kind of DVD collection. I have all these check discs of all these great films, you know, and promo discs, which all it says is the title of the film and the disc, and that's it. You don't have any packaging. And it's like, well, actually, you kind of need the packaging, because if you don't have anything with it at all, you don't actually... It's very difficult to find it, because you're not going to remember off the title alone. You know, if I want to find something... you know, my wife was like, oh, look, there's a new Detroit... Yesterday, she was like, oh, there's a new Detroit Cobras compilation out. Oh, I'd love to hear that. And I was like, oh, actually, I've got that. I forgot. You know, I mean,
yeah, but MP3 though is much
aligned. It's a bloody awful format, isn't it?
Lou Reed was
terrible. I mean, it just loses even more sound quality. You know, I mean, from vinyl to CD, you lose about 50% of the sound, then you lose another 40% of the sound from CD to MP3. It's just horrible.
So we're getting more and more music, but less quality.
Yeah, I mean, the British musician Billy Childish, who's very single-minded.
I think it's definitely rain, not wind now, by the way.
Yeah, do you think?
Yeah.
Is this too loud for you, or are you okay?
We might move inside, I think.
Okay.
That's all right.
You okay?
Yep.
The British musician Billy Childish, I interviewed him last Christmas, and he was saying he just doesn't understand technology. It's like, you know, he's saying, you know, we got 30, 40 years of improvements of technology, and now people listen to music on their bloody mobile phones, which is actually the worst possible way you can listen to music since the gramophone was invented.
You would think with the technology we'd be making it better, not worse.
Yeah, and it's actually making it worse, which is really weird and interesting at the same time. You know, no one seems to have addressed this. I mean, again, all this might be down to is training. You know, maybe, you know, because you and me are older, you know, we're used to a particular sound and realising sound, you know, music can sound a certain way. You know, I guess if all you've been brought up on is the sound of mobile phones and ringtones, you wouldn't even notice. Why would you notice? Because you're not aware. And even if you heard the alternatives, you might just think, well, that's a bit weird. You know, it could just be down to conditioning. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, who's to say one format is really best than the other?
Yep, true. It's all relative.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the music press in this country. I mean, what's your gripe against the music press in Australia?
A wasted opportunity. I hate wasted opportunities. It's the thing that bugs me the most. You know, if you're working for the press in any shape or form, or, you know, if you're doing your podcasts, if I'm working for, like, some crappy free paper, in any shape or form, you have a responsibility. It's not cool to talk about responsibility, but you do. Now, it's up to you to face up to that responsibility. You know, you're being given a great kind of privilege to kind of express your views and kind of help change the world microcosmically, you know, to however small a degree. And it's up to you whether you want to take that or not. Most people don't think about it. Most people are just like, oh, yeah, well, they don't see it in those terms. But that's how I see it. And it really bugs me when people are just like, oh, yeah, but, you know, that's just the way things are. You know, that's just how everything is. Well, how does anything ever get changed then?
When you say responsibility to...
yourself.
To do what?
To change the world. Every time you write or you're interviewing someone, you should be trying to change the world.
And you obviously feel that the music press out here isn't trying to do that. What are they doing if they're not trying to do that, in your opinion?
Well, they're just propping up the status quo.
Right.
And I at any given point, the status quo is never good. You know, I mean, that's why it's the status quo. I mean, obviously, I don't think most people see it in these terms. You know, mm-hmm. They just see themselves as having a good time or not having a good time.
I've got a job to do.
Yeah. What don't I like about it? I had this worked out earlier for a second. well, it's badly designed for starts. There's no history of critical discourse in Australia. I think in the arts, certainly not. I think the reasons for this are probably rooted in the culture, and I don't think they're all bad reasons by any means. I think a lot of them are probably quite positive reasons, in as much as there's no history of critical discourse in Australia because there isn't the same pressure to succeed in certain respects. You know, that pressure cooker that you get in America or Britain, you know, that whole fiercely competitive thing in the arts doesn't really exist over here in Australia. But maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. I mean, it certainly exists in sports. And it's really odd, you know, because Australians always go on about... There's a few things they always go on about. I'm not saying all Australians, I'm just saying, you know, the perception, what the media, mainstream media, portrays about Australia, particularly the Australian media, the tall poppy syndrome. You know, I haven't seen any examples of it. It's the exact opposite of music criticism and arts criticism in this country. Everybody's just kind of given the same kind of level of appraisal, and it's like, oh, good on you, mate, for getting up on stage.
Kylie Minogue in the late 80s, early 90s was the one time I've seen it in music journalism in this country. But then
that's a bit of a soft target, isn't it?
It's a very soft target. And then it came back.
And that's only because she was seen as going to Britain anyway.
And then when she hooked up with Michael Hutchence, we decided she could do no wrong. And she did a duet with Nick Cave, and she was music royalty forever. Which is fair enough. If Nick Cave did a duet with me, I'd expect to be music royalty forever as well.
Well, I won't tell you about the couple of shows of mine he's come along to then. And
yeah, you will. Wait. Let's go back.
And yeah, so there's...
No, you got to tell that story.
Oh, no, I get up on stage sometimes. I've never really believed in rehearsing because I just see that as anathema to the whole idea of live music being spontaneous.
Yeah.
Which always made it very difficult to rehearse with guitarists, to be in a band with guitarists, because guitarists always seem to like to rehearse.
Right. What do you like to do in the band?
I have the microphone.
Right, yes.
And I back in Britain, I was playing about a show a month, and it just so happened I was in a band with my friend Chris, and Chris knew this fellow, Noah Taylor, and so we all ended up in a band together, just making stuff up when we got up on the stage, and Noah Taylor knew Nick Cave, so Nick Cave came down to a couple of shows. He said we were more entertaining than Nina Simone, which is a pretty good quote. It's kind of double-edged as well, which is what I like about it.
Yeah, I don't get either of the edges on that one, but okay. He saw Nina Simone? You have?
Yeah.
Nick had?
Sorry?
Nick had? He said you were more entertaining than Nina
presumably.
Simone? Okay, all right. So, okay, so you've had Nick Cave in the audience. That's pretty cool.
And then I slugged off his band Grinderman, and he didn't come see me again.
And consequently, they didn't get another album?
Well, I think they're doing another album.
Oh, are they? Right. Yeah. Actually, when we were talking about, I was talking before about not getting into albums, when Dig Lazarus Dig came out and I got one of the preview CDs, I remember listening to it like twice or three times, and I just saw the other day, I haven't heard that for a long time. What happened to that? It just kind of disappeared into my huge playlist. And
yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
Whereas in previous years, you know, Nick Cave album would have been set aside for ages. Yeah.
But I, as I say, I think it's a combination of factors. I think it's a combination of your own personal life changing, but also factored in with...
So let's get back to the music press. Now, to me, the way that you describe the music press in this country seems to me to be an accurate reflection of the press in general in this country. They don't want to rock the boat. They just want to, you know, go along with mainstream thought, mainstream opinion, sell as many papers as possible, get as many readers as they can in a declining circulation environment. And you know,
that's interesting, that whole get as many readers as we can in a declining circulation, because you think somebody would go, hang on, our readership's declining. Maybe we're doing something wrong.
Well, I think you're giving them far too much credit.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about coming to Brisbane and this whole ridiculous fuss over the fact that I said I didn't like one Australian band. All right, three.
Three, yeah.
I didn't even know Savage Garden were Australian, actually.
Well, they're not a band.
And I've never heard Silverchair in my life, but I just knew from the sound of their name I didn't like them. I didn't know they were still going, to be honest. Silverchair and Savage Garden.
That was kind of a
shot in the dark with Silverchair, because I was just like, well, you know, one, I bet I wouldn't like them if I heard them. And two, yeah, they're probably still going, because rock bands don't know when to shut up.
They scooped all of the ARIA Awards here like a year ago with their most recent album, man.
You've got to admire music industry awards, you know, people just giving awards for selling records. I mean, that's a really good kind of critical yardstick.
Yeah, right.
So stuff gets played on the radio a lot, gets shown on TV a lot, so people get used to it, so people buy it. So then that makes it more critically worthwhile than anything else.
So we give you an award and it's a positive spiral.
Yeah, it just seems absurd to me. I actually got asked by a radio station a couple of weeks ago who I would have given the awards to if it wasn't Silverchair.
Mm-hmm. And you said?
And I said, well, actually, I don't believe in awards.
Uh-huh.
And they just freaked out.
You're like the Marlon Brando of music critics.
they just couldn't get that concept into their head. Mm. They're like, all right, well, who would you give the Mercury Awards? No, I don't believe in awards.
Mm-hmm.
The only time I ever participated in the end of year readers polls when I used to work for the music press in Britain was when I could fix them myself, because I didn't see the point otherwise.
The only game in turn should be your game, is what you're saying.
Well, no, I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying that's necessarily right. I'm just saying from my own viewpoint.
Yeah.
You know, why bother otherwise?
Unless you're in control of it.
You know, I mean, even like the fated kind of, you know, critical polls, it's like they're just a reflection of lowest common denominator. You know, what's number five on everybody's list of albums of the year gets to be number one.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when was the last time you were surprised by something you heard?
Surprised.
Pleasantly surprised.
There's plenty of music I do like. It's just it's more entertaining to talk about the stuff I don't like. But it's you know that question is actually very difficult because I hear so much stuff all the time. It's actually your mind kind of goes blank when people are like, oh, what do you like at the moment? Because remember, I've seen some really fun shows in town, mostly from out of town bands, but not all from out of town bands. I mean, Greed has played here, Trick has played here, Stereo Total, Tajiko Noriko from Japan.
Yeah.
Who else? A few others, and they were all really fun shows in their own way. Mick Turner played with Jeffrey Wagner, who used to be the drummer of my favourite ever live band ever, full stop, in the history of rock and roll, Laughing Clowns, a Brisbane band. Robert Forster played, and that was a great, great show.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've seen local bands like Flamingo Crush, who've got a great drummer, Gin Club, who are kind of all over the shop, which is very endearing.
Have you seen Go, 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 Go?
No, I haven't seen
that. Two large girls wearing kilts, one on drums, one on guitar. They claim the guitar hasn't been tuned for 7 months. I saw them at Rick's Bar last week, and it was great. It was like the White Stripes with no talent. Just loud and raucous and very, very funny.
The White Stripes with no talent, that would just be the White Stripes with Jack White then.
Now, you wrote a book on the White Stripes.
Yeah, but my favourite member's Meg White.
Your favourite member?
Yeah, she's what makes the White Stripes.
Because she's just so endearingly bad?
No, she's a great drummer.
She's like Mo Tucker, but with no timing, man.
Mo Tucker's a fantastic drummer.
That's what I said, with no timing.
No, which is why she's great.
It's very rock and roll.
My reasoning on why Meg White is what makes the White Stripes so special is very straightforward. You know, there are any number of great guitarists, there are any number of really great vocalists, there are any number of people who write songs, but they don't sell millions of records. So why do the White Stripes sell millions of records? Because of their drummer. She's the kind of mystery factor that makes that band so special.
You could be right. How did they keep their marriage secret for so long? That's what I want to know.
I don't think it was secret, but hadn't they split up before or around about the time White Stripes were going anyway?
But for the first like 5 or 6 years, they were big. They were telling everyone they were brother and sister. And
I think they only said that once.
Yeah, I saw it
and
quoted just, everywhere. And
I know, people just
picked it up.
Didn't bother checking.
No investigative journalism.
I just think that's fantastic. I love it when bands do stuff like that. You know, I think that's really amusing. I love it when people just make up ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
And people just print it. I mean, I would print that. You know, of course I print it because it's funny. I wouldn't care whether it's real or not. It's funny.
I think it's funnier to know that they're an ex-couple. So you like the White Stripes?
Yeah, I think they're fine, yeah. I'm a little surprised they've released as many albums as they have at this point in time, but yeah, I think they're pretty good.
I mean,
I never saw I never saw them in any particular small venues. I saw them on their first UK tour, but that wasn't particularly small, you know. That was a big one, say, the Vines one. But yeah. I mean, there are other bands from Detroit I prefer a lot,
like
White Stripes, Dirt Bombs in particular. Mick Collins, who used to be in a band called The Gorys, which were a major influence on the White Stripes. I saw a video from Texas. I've been wanting to see this video. I knew about it, called Inside/Out, which was a document of the Athens, Texas scene that both REM and the B-52s came out of in the early 80s. And there's a band in that documentary called the Flat Duo Jets, and you're watching them and you're like, oh my God. Not only did Jack White rip off his vocal style from this guy, he also ripped off his guitar style and the way he looks.
But the Flat Duo Jets didn't have Meg.
They didn't have Meg. I mean, yeah. My point exactly. you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Jack understands the entire, you know, point about restraint, you know, less is more, you know, less is always more. You know, obviously he understands that. And the smartest thing he ever did was asking Meg to drum for him. He knew what he was doing when he asked for kind of deliberately kind of childlike drummer to drum, you know, with him, because he knew that would kind of, you know, his other band, Raconteurs, so horrible.
Yes, yeah,
you know, they're
boring,
so horrible. It's just a bluesy
boring
Jack. Well, it's not surprising because Meg exercises that restraint that
she's
Jack
she's
knows
the
that he needs.
To Jack and,
you know, he knows he needs that restraint because otherwise he'd just be an awful, awful muso.
Yeah, just another sort of Delta blues rock band.
Yeah.
So tell me, in order to make music journalism...
Oh, and certainly the reason Nirvana were one of the most exciting bands I ever saw was because my central credo for rock music is that spontaneity is at the heart of all great rock music.
Yeah.
And the thing about Nirvana Live is you never, ever knew, not even when they were playing the stadium gigs, you never knew what was going to happen next. Whether it would all fall apart, whether, you know, somebody... You know, somebody would stage dive into the back of the bounce and the bounce would try to beat up the band. You know, whether Chris would be throwing his bass 7 feet up in the air, whether they'd actually just play a great song. You know, you never knew what was going to be happening next. And that's what I loved about the birthday party. That's what I loved about Olympia Band Beat happening in their own kind of minimal anti-rock way. You know, that because there was always this kind of undercurrent of tension at the gigs as well. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you, it's not really a competition anyway, but I wouldn't be able to tell you who's better, Birthday Party or Nirvana, because I was at different ages when I saw those bands. But certainly they were two of the most thrilling, simply because you just didn't know what the hell was going to be happening at any given point. And also the Birthday Party split up before they ever got, you know, really hugely massive. So they're always at kind of good size venues for that to be going on.
So it's not about the music as much as it is about the energy?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, obviously the music's an important factor, but it's never just about the music. It's about the music, it's about the look, it's about the energy, it's about who you're with at the time, it's about who else is there, you know, it's about how good the PA sounds, you know, all of these things.
When did you first see Nirvana?
In 1989, February 89. This is contended, actually, which surprises me, but as far as I know, I was the first journalist from outside of Seattle to interview them. As far as I know, I did their third ever interview. I wasn't like particularly prescient in doing that. I was just over there to do a story on the label, Sub Pop, and they were one of the bands they asked me to interview. I actually thought they sucked when I saw them live. They had a fourth member at that point in time, the couple of months he was in the band. He later joined Soundgarden, and they were just basically a bad imitation of Soundgarden. I liked Soundgarden fine at that point, but I didn't need somebody imitating them. It was especially disappointing because I actually really liked the first Nirvana single, which was the only thing available at the time. And so I was just like, oh, well, this isn't very good.
But obviously, you know, you stuck with them?
Their first UK show, again, opinions really massively divided on this, but their first UK show, which was this big Sub Pop showcase at the Astoria London called Lame Fest in, I think that was 1989 as well, towards the end, with Tad and Martoni. Nirvana went on first. By all accounts, they're absolutely awful that night. I was there. I can't remember whether they're good or bad, to be honest. What I do remember was that they absolutely trashed the stage, you know, just completely left it for dead. Amplifiers, PA systems, guitars, just the entire stage was just empty. They just, you know, it was just absolute mayhem. I know some of the people there thought they, you know, that was just, you know, really low kind of, you know, it's like that's just wrong, you know, that's not playing music, that's just like, but it's like, it's entertainment, you know, if you're having a bad night, why not trash the stage, you know, because at least you're going to entertain the audience then. So, did I stick with them? Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, I got up on stage with them a few times because it was just amusing to do so, because that's what I did. And they thought it was amusing.
What did you do when you got on stage?
Oh, I mean, I can't play guitar, so I'd always be at the microphone. A couple of times, you know, put his guitar over my head or something. But one, I can't play guitar. Two, he's left-handed, and I'm not. You know.
And the whole story of you introducing Kurt and Courtney, how did that come about?
I used to write for Melody Maker. It was 1991. I made Courtney's band Hole single of the week, their first two singles in Melody Maker. Loved the records, didn't know anything about the band at all, didn't know who Courtney Love was, just loved the records. I've been turned on to them, piecing it all together afterwards, by a Minneapolis band, Babes in Toyland, who Kat and Courtney used to be on-off good best friends kind of thing, real love-hate thing. And I used to love Babes in Toyland. And I think Kat passed my address on to Courtney. Thanks, Kat. And so I loved those first two singles. I really wanted to, you know, I really wanted just to interview this band because I just loved their music so much. And I was in LA for the first time, and I went out to see a show second night I got there. Butthole Surfers, L7 and Red Cross at the Hollywood Palladium. And I bumped into John Silver, who I knew because... Why do I know John? I think I knew him via Sonic Youth because he was their manager. He was also the manager of the Beastie Boys, but I don't think it was via that. And unknown to me, he'd also just started managing Nirvana. it was around the time Nirvana... Well, it was the time Nirvana were recording Nevermind. And so I bump into John at this gig and I'm like, John, this band Hole, they're playing in LA in 7 days' time. I think they're from Minneapolis. Do you know anything about this singer, Courtney Love? Because I really want to, you know, make sure I get to meet her and, you know, I'm going to stick around in town if I can. And he's like, no, she's from LA. And in fact, she's here now. I'll introduce you. So he introduced me and we got on really well. I mean, I was totally excited to meet her because loved her music. She was really excited to meet me. Because I don't know if people know this or not, but Courtney Love's a bit of a media whore.
You never would have picked that up about her. No.
And she was really super excited to meet like a real live music critic from the UK. You know, especially I had a certain reputation even then, and she knew who the hell I was. Well, I was partly responsible for making her friend Cat's band quite well known in the UK at that point. So we got on really well, and we went around nicking people's drinks, and Courtney's not really a drinker, actually never has been. I think one of L7 slipped acid in my drink, and he went around drinking and getting larrier and larrier. And at some point we started fighting, and I can't really remember why this would have happened, but I suspect it would have been because she would have started like heavily flirting with me, and I would have been like, you know, you don't have to sleep with me to make me like your band, because I like your band anyway. How about that? So we started punching each other and wrestling and rolling around on the floor near the velvet rope that separates the VIPs from the plebs. I think we were trying to roll underneath it, but I think the bouncers probably spotted us. And around that point, and again, this is kind of me just guessing, really. Around that point, Nirvana walked in, and I suspect, again... Kurt kind of sees his English buddy, who he knew because I've been up on stage with him, rolling around on the floor with this unknown blonde woman, obviously having more fun than the rest of the place put together, and just made a beeline for us, ran over, jumped in on top of us and started punching both of us, which is how they met.
How would you describe the relationship between the two of them?
Volatile, but you know, they were pretty close. Like, you know, relationships can be.
Good thing for Kurt's music, his relationship with Courtney?
Oh, yeah, I'd say. I think Inutra is the best album he did. And that has her influence all over it. He wasn't that good a lyric writer. Certainly not on Nevermind. It's like, you know, what the hell are all those songs about? He actually learned how to structure, you know, words and stuff on Inutra, and that clearly is, you know, Courtney, for whatever fault, she was always a great lyric writer.
I've always been a big fan of Hole, much to a lot of people's disgust around me, but I think it's good music.
Yeah, I liked the first album.
Even the last one that they did, I didn't mind.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a bit more commercial, but I didn't mind it. There's something about Courtney's voice. I like Courtney's voice.
Yeah, you ever heard Cat Bjelland? Cat Bjelland from Babes in Toyland?
I've heard Babes in Toyland a long time ago, yeah.
Okay, because Courtney was pretty influenced by Cat.
Yeah. Well, everyone's influenced by somebody.
Oh, yeah, well, that's for sure.
So let's finish up by talking about what you'd like to see happen with the music industry here and the time that you're going to be in Brisbane.
I don't mind. I wouldn't mind somebody giving me some work.
You'd like some money, yeah. You'd like some work. Yeah, we understand that. This is we'll put the shout out. I'm sure that's going to happen.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure it is, actually. I am already starting to think that I probably won't get work in Australia for whatever reason, possibly because it's a lot smaller place than it thinks itself to be, but it's confused about that at the moment. I don't know, maybe I'll be proved wrong. I mean, just in my own, you know, I take pride in what I do, although people don't realise that sometimes, and it angers me when people don't take the same pride. or I don't think they do. And it comes down to wasted opportunities again. So, you know, in terms of just critical discourse, you know, this street press, I mean, you know, they're free. You don't have to worry what the readers think about what you're writing because it's free. It doesn't make any difference. They're not going to stop buying it because they don't buy it in the first place. So why don't you write what the hell you like? That's it, really. People are like, oh, well, we can't because of the advertisers. Well, okay, get different advertisers. And they're like, oh, well, we can't because then we wouldn't exist because then nobody... And they are starting to get it. I think that would probably be a good thing.
It's the same thing with the rest of the press in this country.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, but I'm just a little bit more familiar with them. I'm sure it is. No one wants to rot the boat because they've got their coast. But the crucial difference between the street press and the mainstream press is at least people get paid for writing for the mainstream press. You know, and it's like I can understand people wanting to hold on to their cushy little numbers, just kind of, you know, reviewing the new Shania Twain DVD as it comes in or whatever it is. You know, I can understand that because, you know, it's a nice way to make a living, really. If you get into that gig, you don't want to be rocking a boat. You'd have to be pretty stupid to do that. You might end up at 47 with no income at all. So I can understand that. But what I don't understand is the people lower down the chain, you know, the street press, who don't get paid. And it's like, why wouldn't you be writing what the hell you wanted if you're not getting paid? You know, the success of your magazines. It's like, and people are like, oh, no, but it's because, you know, the advertisers, you know, they wouldn't just be like the advertisers. And I'm like, well, you know, I think probably Brisbane would be a lot better off without most of its street press. I mean, quite honestly. I mean, what purpose does it serve?
Gig guides.
Yeah, but you could do that on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, you really could so easily do that on the internet. It doesn't serve any purpose at all except for contributing to, you know, a bit more deforestation. And just contributing to the everyday grey mundanity of life, and that to me is the biggest crime of all. You know, people who just willingly contribute to everyday grey.
The rise of mediocrity in Australian society. It's everywhere. Look at our Prime Minister. You got any hopes for the music industry? Is it?
Well, I hope it just completely folds and devours itself, quite honestly. I mean, I think it's absolutely brilliant that these major labels are falling by the wayside. You know, I mean, that's obviously can only be to the good. I don't know. Musicians are pretty stupid as a bunch, and they've got too high self opinion. So maybe they do need someone kind of holding their hand in terms of and taking their life away from them. I don't know, but I mean, I would have thought. You know, I prefer personally. You know, if I'm not happy with something, or I don't think I can get work somewhere. My instinct is always to start off my own alternative, and I don't really understand why more musicians don't listen. You know, I really don't understand that. It's because they want to get rich or famous off it. It's like, well, give up now, you know, because that's not going to happen.
Mm.
You know, how many musicians are there in the world? How many are actually famous or rich off the back of it?
We said that if you took any other industry and said, look, 0.001% of the people in this industry are going to be incredibly wealthy, another, you know, 1% are going to make a mediocre living out of it, and the rest are going to be waiting tables while they're carrying out their profession. It would be insane. I mean, if you said that about law or about accounting or anything, everyone would just fall up, right?
But no, I mean, I think it's super healthy that you know, the means of that. I still think, although there's a lot of, as I'm sure you're very aware, there's a lot of corporate interest in the internet and a lot of, you know, unseen kind of corporations controlling elements of it, I still think it's brilliant that they still haven't figured a way to completely control it at this point in time. I'm not saying they won't have done in a few years' time, but at the moment, you know, I mean, you can argue all you like about Google, which is actually a really great example. Whoever controls the search engine controls the net, isn't that right? You know, because that's how people discover stuff, which is what Google, why they were so smart. But I do think it's incredibly healthy that people can just find out for themselves. I think MySpace, even if it is Murdoch-controlled, I don't give a fuck. I think it's fantastic because, you know, it's such a brilliant way to discover music. You know, MP3s, whatever, it's still a brilliant way to randomly discover
music. Is that how you discover music?
It's just really fun. It's not necessarily how I discover music, but it's just really fun to go on for a while and just go cruising along it or YouTube or something. It's just really fun, you know, and that's ultimately what it should be. It should just be fun.
What about tools like Last.fm? Do you use any of those?
I was on Last.fm, but I found it way too intrusive.
Mm.
I just didn't like all the stuff that went along with it. I just, you know, same as Facebook, I find it quite objectionable, some of the tools they have, which are just meant to be for your enjoyment, but quite clearly are designed to kind of tap into your information,
mm-hmm.
and they're just a bit too blatant for my liking.
Give people one band they should go and check out. That they probably haven't heard of.
Oh, okay. I was going to say the Beatles.
How very mainstream of you.
Well, you know, they put out some good records. Spice Girls, an undervalued band.
I went and checked out Stereo Hotel after reading about
Stereo Hotel.
That's kind of quirky stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, just go onto MySpace and start cruising. Because, you know, why would my taste have any reflection on anybody else's?
You're a filter, Mr. True. Come on.
But you'd have to understand my context and where I come from. I mean, when I started writing about music for the music press in the 80s, I noticed at that point in time that the only journalists I ever paid any attention to were the ones whose taste I actually understood. Whether I liked it or didn't like it, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that guy likes it. Well, maybe I will, because I know his taste or her taste.
Yeah.
So that's all I ever aimed to do, was get myself in a position where people would know what I stood for.
Yeah.
So, but at this point in time, in Brisbane 2008, no one actually knows what I like. So it's pretty pointless my recommendation.
Most of the people listening to this don't live in Brisbane, man.
Well, all right, in Australia, even.
Or in Australia.
All right. Well, anyway. so most people don't actually know what the music I like.
So there's no context around.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, I'd have to list you like 300 really well-known bands and then say, then at the end of it go, oh, here's a band that if you like these 300 bands, you might like.
Then you might like it.
But then again, you might as well go on a MySpace. You know, I'm completely irrelevant.
You sound like an internet service. You might also like.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, that's kind of how it's sold a lot of music criticism now, music magazines nowadays. It's like, if you like this, you might like this.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I'm completely irrelevant, you know. I've always contended music journalists are like gods. We're only powerful if you believe in us.
Yeah.